Good afternoon. I'll call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Here.
Vice Chair Cotizza-Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Here.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Here.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly. Representative Lislegard.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
On the hunt for real roses for this Sunday.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Here.
Representative Rasmussen.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Present.
Representative Haley. And Representative Lilly.
Quorum is present. The first item on our agenda. Actually, before we get to that, just a quick announcement. We do have a floor session today, as members know, at 4:30, which is our usual adjournment time. We will conclude this committee just a couple minutes before that to allow House information to get over to the floor session, virtually, of course. The first item on our agenda is approval of our minutes from yesterday. Representative Cotizza-Watoon, have you had a chance to review the minutes from yesterday?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes from February 9th.
Any discussion to the Cotizza-Watoon motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails and the minutes from February 9th, 2021 are approved. Our first bill, we have four bills on the agenda today. The first bill is House File 109. Representative Knorr is joining us for that bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Knorr. And I will move that your House File 109 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy. And with that, Representative Knorr, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The House File 109 is a bill that we had during the previous session, just before the COVID-19. Members, I don't know if you recall, on November 27, 2019, there was a fire that occurred in my district on the 14th floor on a high-rise building. Unfortunately, we lost five individuals. Those five individuals were lost just simply because we didn't have sprinklers on a high-rise building. Our community came together. They supported each other. In fact, they also supported the firefighters, who one of them was injured during trying to help and prevent further losses. Members, during that day, I saw the lights, I saw the smoke, I walked over to the building. I saw the bodies being brought down from the building. Our community still feels the pain that we could have done something, not only in last year or last session, but in 1994 and 1995. We've heard from previous leaders who said that was a mistake. This simple bill requires that any high-rise building that is almost 74 feet high, which is above the ladder, for any firefighter to retrofit sprinklers so that we can save lives. Members, if you haven't read, there was a report issued by the Department of Public Safety saying that if there was a sprinkler on that building, we could have saved lives during that day. Mr. Chair, I wanted to welcome Tom Brace, who is going to give us more details with his deep understanding of this challenge.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Mr. Brace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Brace. I'm the Minnesota coordinator for the National Fire Sprinkler Association. My past history, I was the Washington State Fire Marshal for 10 years. and I was Minnesota's state fire marshal for 16 years. I'm an unabashed sprinkler advocate. I think that we have a opportunity here, as Representative Knorr so elegantly stated, to prevent this loss of life of five people. The state fire marshal's report is excellent. I thought I would go to a couple of basic points that you will hear, and maybe some of your members have questions about. You have 12 years, count them, 12 years to comply. Your program after 2 years, you will work with the state fire marshal's division for your plan. There's a lot of misconceptions about sprinkler systems. One of them in Hollywood films, one head goes off, they all go off. That's not true. One head at a time. And we believe in, like, the fire that Representative Knorr described, Cedar Riverside, probably one sprinkler head in one unit would have knocked that fire down to a manageable size, if not absolutely extinguish it. The issues, cost is always one. First of all, there's 12 years to do this. There are some genuine insurance savings. I was looking at some numbers here preparing for my testimony, and some occupancies, 62-68% savings in property insurance. We'd like to say that in about 7 years, a commercial property would recognize insurance savings to pay for the installation of the sprinkler system. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention firefighters. If you recall, the Cedar Riverside fire was on the 14th floor. Can you imagine what it was like to schlep all that hardware, hoses, and other firefighting paraphernalia up 14 floors and then fight that fire? Minneapolis did a magnificent job. They were located right across the street virtually from that fire. So we urge you to pass this much-needed legislation, and I stand ready for any questions or comments anyone might choose to offer.
Thank you, Mr. Brace. Representative Knorr, I think you have a couple more testifiers.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I see George Sherman, who we just talked about the cost savings. So I think he can speak to what he has done with his properties in retrofitting and his perspective.
Thank you. Yes. Mr. Sherman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, committee members. This is George Sherman with Sherman Associates. And I had a chance to talk to your committee or to the legislature last year in support of this bill. Our firm, Sherman Associates, owns a number of high-rise buildings throughout the state of Minnesota in Duluth, Rochester, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. And we are in support of this bill as a private owner. We've retrofitted our own buildings over the last 10 years to include fire sprinkler systems and have for full coverage of our buildings. And we know it's a life safety issue. It isn't about concrete buildings burning. It's about the materials inside of the units that burn, the mattresses, the carpets, the couches. And those are the components that put out smoke, put out flames, and cause the loss of life. We have seen a significant amount of insurance savings just even in our own concrete buildings. And as a private owner, I think there is an obligation to provide safe housing for residents. We do encourage the support of this bill. We do think that some of the provisions of the bill, the particular working with the state fire department, is important to allow for some flexibility and coverage ratios for buildings that are already existing. It may not always be possible to sprinkle a closet or some of the areas that are coverage are required in new buildings, but the importance is to be able to cover living rooms and bedrooms and exit areas and units to put out the major fires to give individuals time to get out of their units. I think 12 years is enough time. I do think there should be some flexibility in normal coverage requirements for sprinkler heads that may be a little bit more flexible than new construction. As a private owner, we're in support of this bill. We've done it to our buildings, and we've seen both the life safety improved, the resident satisfaction improved. We've seen insurance savings. We do acknowledge there's a cost, but the cost is offset by the insurance, but more so by the feeling, by the knowledge of taking care of our residents. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you. Representative Knorr, I believe you have one more testifier.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have David Ibarra.
Mr. Ibarra.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. As mentioned, my name is David Ibarra, Y-B-A-R-R-A. I am president of Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. I will share with you that I'm also a licensed sprinkler fitter in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota Pipe Trades Association is an umbrella organization representing nearly 10,000 men and women working in piping-related industries throughout the state of Minnesota, including licensed craft professionals that install, maintain, and repair automatic fire sprinkler systems in residential, commercial, and industrial applications. We are fully supportive of House File 109 and would like to thank Representative Knorr for authoring this important piece of legislation, as well as the other representatives that have signed on as co-authors. There is an abundance of data that reflects the effectiveness of automatic fire sprinkler systems in saving lives and protecting property. Nonetheless, the occurrence of a tragic event is often what initiates dialogue, raising awareness of the need for sprinkler systems. I submit the following examples. In 1980, fire at the MGM Hotel in Las Vegas, resulting in 85 fatalities and more than 600 injuries. In the year 2000, at Bolin Hall Dormitory at Seton Hall University, a fire caused 3 deaths and 58 injuries. In 2003, fires at nursing home facilities in Hartford, Connecticut, and Nashville, Tennessee occurred, resulting in more than 30 fatalities. All of these tragedies, as a result, legislation or policy change was adopted. Now, all buildings open to the public in the state of Nevada require sprinklers. All dormitories in the state of New Jersey require sprinklers. And the Government Accountability Office recommended nursing homes have automatic sprinklers beginning in 2004. And now the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid now require sprinkler systems for facilities participating in their reimbursement program. Understand that testimony needs to be brief, so that is my testimony. Just want to conclude by saying that I firmly believe that House File 109 will go a long ways to ensure that another tragedy is avoided in the state of Minnesota, and I respectfully ask for your support of House File 109. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ibarra. There are no further testifiers signed up, so we'll move to member discussions and questions. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a few questions, basically to get to know the bill a little bit better and what you're looking for. And I'm just wondering, I think this will be for you, Representative Knorr. Do you know about how many, especially in the metro area, that'll need to retrofit? Do we have any idea of how many places we're asking to do this?
Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Representative Tice. I'll give you what we need for Minneapolis. We have got 26 high-rise buildings that don't have sprinklers in Minneapolis alone. And those are public housing, most of them. I just wanted to ask if Tom Brace has got more details. Mr. Brace, I think we received that detail from the previous conversation from the fire marshal, the state fire marshal.
Mr. Brace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We queried the state fire marshal and other sources. A voluntary reporting indicated about 43 buildings across the state would be affected, we believe would be affected by this piece of legislation. Obviously, a strong metro orientation or a urban like a Rochester, like a Duluth, that type of situation. I think the city of St. Paul is two or three. They've had a program for many years that they went ahead and sprinkled over a 20-year period. So we would certainly not say there isn't an impact, but we believe that number to be fairly accurate.
Thank you, Mr. Brace. And Representative Tice, I did check with the fire chief in Coon Rapids. I didn't get a chance to talk to Champlin, but there's none in Coon Rapids, in case you were curious about Coon Rapids, Representative Tice. Representative Tice.
Well, there could be in St. Cloud. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question that kind of goes with it is, if any of them are on, like, the historic register, will they be required to do this?
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've seen Mr. Brace wanted to respond to that question, too.
Ah, Mr. Brace.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a literal reading of this bill, the answer to the representative would be yes. However, there is a long and significant history of working with properties that are on the National Historic Register and sprinkling them. So it seems to me that a literal reading, if it meets the 75-foot height or more, the answer is an affirmative. But that would be the kind of thing that you would want to get into discussion with the state fire marshal in terms of your plan and how and if it could be sprinkled.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Brace. And the reason I'm asking is I was in remodeling a building for 30 years, and I know there's always some special limits of what you can do to something that's on the historic. And I'm thinking with a lot of these, because they need to be retrofitted, they're probably older buildings. So I just wanted to hear that. Also, probably Representative Knorr, will there be any type of grants or help for those folks that cannot afford to do maybe a full retrofit? I know 12 years is a long time, but with some of these buildings, a lot of times the cost of just taking care of them and keeping them up to, you know, to a place where they can have them available for rent is a lot of money. So will there be any, have you heard of any, or will there be any type of grants for folks to apply to so that they can do this?
Representative Knorr.
Representative Tice, I think that question came up last time. More than a half, as I told you, 26 public housing in Minneapolis need some sort of retrofitting. That means there's a federal responsibility. And also, if we can take a look at more funding for the public housing, we funded, I believe, $16 million during the previous capital investment. That is a conversation that is ongoing. We would like to see that funding go towards retrofitting some of the high-rise building. In fact, Minneapolis high-rise building, they've already put out some capital investment of their own, as much as they can do. So this is an ongoing discussion, not only through our state, but also at the federal level, where there was a bill introduced by Senator Tina Smith and Senator Amy Klobuchar to make sure that we can find resources, along with Representative Omar in the Congress, to ensure that there's funding from the federal government. Likewise, I think there's also some reserve account. If we require this bill to proceed, the public housing may receive funding from the federal government based on the legislation that we have.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I'm just kind of curious about that is there really isn't much data out there about what the costs are. And I'm seeing that it might take 1 to 1.5 to 2 days to do one unit, and some folks are looking at, you know, $2,500 plus per unit, and that can get kind of spendy when you've got quite a few units in a building. So I just want to make sure that if we put this in place that we are going to have some monies that at least people can apply to make sure that they have it. I do have some questions about insurance and the savings. You know, I'm not sure. I know that Mr. Cocking is here, but I don't know, does anybody else have any? I'd just like to know about the insurance part of it. I think when we first heard about sprinklers in family homes, we heard, you know, they were saying, oh, it's going to be such a big insurance savings. And then we were finding out that it wasn't as easy as that, there's more instance for something to happen to the home, kid burning a pizza or whatever. So if somebody can just talk about, you know, is there indeed a big insurance savings like we're hearing, or is it not quite as big as maybe we're thinking? Thank you.
Yes, and Mr. Cocking is on the call here, and I think he's nodding that he would answer that question. Mr. Cocking, if you could just identify yourself for the tape, and then if you have an answer to Representative Tice's question.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Aaron Cocking, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Yes, and I, Representative Tice, Mr. Chairman, Representative Tice, I thought this question might come up, which is why I wanted to avail myself to the committee. I would say, first of all, the insurance industry supports sprinklers. The savings in property and the savings in lives, we believe, is indisputable. As far as the cost, I think Mr. Sherman probably, with his firsthand experience, was able to attest that he certainly saw insurance savings as a result of retrofitting his buildings to include sprinklers. Certainly insurance is priced to match what that risk is. And when you put sprinklers in to preserve property and to preserve life, there is certainly going to be some savings on the insurance side of things. I don't want to get into trying to quantify what individual companies do on an underwriting basis, but I do think it is safe to assume that there will be some insurance savings because the risk is lessened.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Cocking. This winter, I lost a cousin in a house fire, and I just believe that, you know, we need to look at this, and I'm just also very concerned about the costs, and just want to make sure we do a good job and don't put something out there that owners are going to not be able to do, and then maybe we lose that housing in the market. We can't afford to lose the housing in the market because we have a shortage already. So for me, I just, you know, if they can retrofit, maybe get some monies to help and then see savings and insurance costs, you know, that's a win-win. And we will keep the housing that we have and have it a lot safer. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Representative Tyson. Very sorry to hear about your family loss this winter.
Thank you. That's
awful. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Knorr, the second time I've heard this bill, I heard the bill last year in Public Safety Committee. And just as I said then, I'll repeat now, condolences to you, your community, the family members of those that were impacted, the friends. And again, it's just a deep, tragic loss, and our hearts for all of us across Minnesota go out to you and all of those who had to unfortunately and still endure this tragedy. Because I'll see this bill again later this week, I won't ask all of my questions right now. The first would be on the testifier, and I forget the gentleman's name, but who is the building owner now, and along the lines of what Representative Tice was just asking, the testifier said the cost of insulation is offset by the insurance savings. So I'm wondering if the building owner would be able to tell us can he quantify what the cost was per unit that he had to incur versus what, when he says that it is offset, well, in what time frame?
I see Mr. Sherman is still on the call and has his hand up. So I think that's who you're referring to, Representative Lucero. So Mr. Sherman? I believe you are muted, Mr. Sherman. There we go.
This is George Sherman, and we've done a number of very large building retrofits of fairly large buildings, everywhere from 100 units up to 1,400 units. And the cost varies dramatically depending upon the amount of water service, water main services you have to bring in. And so typically the cost is anywhere from we found probably $2,000 for the fire sprinkler system itself to $2,500. But you'll probably incur another $2,000 per unit to repair sheetrocking or to make the fire sprinkler system look acceptable for housing. So it is not inexpensive. I think people should start thinking it's $3,000 to $4,500 per unit. Our insurance savings was in part on property, and mostly because more insurance carriers will consider covering your buildings. And if you have more people who will bid on your insurance, you'll probably get better rates. As the insurance commissioner mentioned, the insurance industry favors sprinkler buildings. And if building portfolios do not have enough buildings that are sprinkled, you may very well find that you will no longer get insurance on one building or any of your buildings. So you are considered a better class of insurance property, so you'll get better rates. The real savings, though, is probably on your liability side of your insurance. As a property owner, even if the fire is not your fault, if it's an accident, if there's a loss of life, you will probably get involved in some type of a liability claim. And there's where your insurance savings can be substantial, both in your form of your deductible and in your premium. So I would encourage people to think of this as more of a if there is a savings on the liability side if you do have an event. On the property insurance side, it's more of a issue of being able to get more insurance companies to bid on your properties and to get more competitive rates. I do encourage the state and to continue to try to find funds for people to, help small business owners, small property owners to pay for this. You want the buildings to have fire sprinkler systems. And I think we need to look at ways to help small building owners to have the adequate resources to help pay for the fire sprinkler systems. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'll only ask about half my questions here, so I'll just go with two more, I think, at this point. The next question is to Representative Knorr, I think, or maybe the fire official, and that is on line 1.9 of the bill. It reads, so this is defining the scope of who is going to be in required. Is 75 feet or more above the lowest level of fire department vehicle access? I'm wondering if you can interpret what that means, and specifically fire department vehicle access, because as a former city council member myself, I know that every municipality will have different types of fire equipment. And I heard that there was a reference to the height of a ladder, but not every fire municipality has fire equipment that may even have a ladder or ladders that go to different heights. So does this mean, Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr, could you help interpret this? And does it potentially mean that there will be a different height requirement in different municipalities simply due to the different fire equipment that that municipality has?
Well, I can see that Mr. Brace is ready to answer that, but I don't know, Representative Knorr, I'll certainly give you the first crack since it's your bill. Or would you like to defer to Mr. Brace?
Mr. Brace is well qualified to answer that question, Mr. Chair.
Terrific. Mr. Brace.
Mr. Chair, Representative, imagine a fire truck driven up to the side of a building and the ladder raised. There, about a 100-foot ladder is the maximum that any local fire department would have access to. So the idea of 75 feet would be that you would be, once again, 75% of the way up the ladder, but you're not getting onto the ladder for evacuation at the very top. Where it becomes another issue is, say, can you imagine a building where you have it, the front you could drive up to 75 feet, but the back drops off substantially down the side of a hill, and you couldn't get access to the backside because you couldn't drive a fire truck around it to the backside. So that would be factored into the 75 feet or more consideration.
Thank you. And for those keeping score at home, we did just get another Representative Lucero job in his question there, City Councilor. So we can add that to the list. Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't know there was a tally going on.
Oh, we'll keep it all session on.
I don't know if we've missed Bagel Day, but I used to work at Burger's Bagels, and I got a whole other long list of jobs.
Yeah, save them out. You don't need to do them multiple in one day.
I'll string them out over time. Yes, totally. Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Brace, for that answer. I don't think I entirely got an answer to my question, but I can. We don't need to do this now. I can talk with the bill author offline. But just to press what I think my concern is: while I understand that there's an average, you know, of ladder height, and while I know that some municipalities may have access, there may be others that don't have access or have access to a lesser height ladder than potentially a 75 or 100 foot ladder. I don't know. I don't know what it's like around the state, nor do I know the number of buildings that this might impact in outside of the metro area. I don't know what that number is. But then I'll just finish with this, and this is more of a comment than a question, and that is, I'm very the value of buildings when it comes to real estate, whether it be residential or commercial buildings, and as an owner of both residential and commercial buildings, I'm very sensitive to when government, when there's an owner who makes an informed decision based on potential deficiencies in the property or property that might not be in code or whatever it might need, that is factored into the purchase price. So because I've been in a position where I made an informed decision at a point in time, paid a fair market value, but then government changed the rules on me after I had made the purchase of a building, and now it had a significant detrimental impact on the value of my building, whereas I wish I would have known that in advance and could have factored that into what I would have paid for it. So what I'm sensitive to right now is that you might have owners that either they've owned the building for a number of years, or let's say they just did a transaction this year, and government comes in, and now they put on this mandate that wasn't factored into the purchase price that was just paid. So anyway, I'm just sensitive to that, and I think that we all need to be sensitive to, even though it is 12 years, right? It could be millions of dollars, which now the new buyer is mandated to have to pay, and that helps or hurts the bottom line. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a very, very important topic. I don't disagree, and I have some questions. I know that this has been working for a few years, and I'm just going to kind of contain it to one quick topic area. We were given a number earlier, and I did not get a chance to jot it down, as to how many buildings are affected here in the state of Minnesota by the proposed legislation that's before the committee right now. Do we have a breakdown as to how many of those units are privately owned, how many of those are owned perhaps by the state of Minnesota or political subdivisions? And I'll explain why I think that's important. A number of these buildings may have rent subsidy or rent controls on them because of the age of the buildings, because of catering to different populations and what have you, and needs of people. My concern is that sometimes we may have a situation where the building owner doesn't have the resources in which to be able to do the work necessary based on the cash flow and the reserves that might need to be set aside to accomplish a goal like this, as well as meet other landlord tenant obligations that are found in state statute for the upkeep and habitability of the facility in the building. So maybe Representative Noor, you could maybe give me a little bit of an overview as to what kind of evidence or information or data you've been able to gather or collect on it. I don't need to have specifics. I just want to know which direction we'd be going and kind of where things are at. I think that's going to be the big stopping point on this, is where do the resources come for making something like this happen? And if it's a publicly owned building, I understand public dollars would go. If it's a privately owned building, we take public dollars and put those into privately owned buildings. And how does that look and how does that work? And I fear that some of these may not be accomplished, which we did end up displacing some folks from their homes as a result of it. I realize it's a big question. It's more just kind of a dump of thoughts that I have as I'm contemplating how I want to move forward with my vote on this particular bill.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a good question. I think the number that we were given by the fire marshal is 43. As I noted, within the public housing in Minneapolis, almost 26. And looking on the other side within my district, I do have two high-rise buildings, which are not owned by nonprofits. They're 25 floors each. And those also require retrofitting of sprinklers. Given that there is a disproportionate impact to many of residents who are low income, seniors, individuals with disabilities, I think this is prudent upon us to look into the cost savings based on the loss of lives, even if there's damage without any loss of life, compared to 2,000 and some to 4,000 per unit. So we know there will be challenges, and I look forward to bringing bill forward to support the publicly owned and also extend through the housing infrastructure bond some resources to allow retrofitting. So that's a different conversation on the funding. And this is a 12-year project. We can at least start doing something now rather than later. We don't want to come back here again because of a loss or tragic incidents. We can take care of those issues now and save lives.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Noor. I know that my question doesn't have solid answers to them available, and I'm clearly aware of that. But these are things I would like you, Representative Noor, and your advocates to think about is how do we work with the privately owned and versus the publicly owned? And a lot of these privately owned may also have subsidies that restrict how much money can be raised in rents and different kinds of things to cover some of these costs. And so there's just a lot of moving parts, excuse me, that I think need to be addressed in this. And so I would just ask that you take those comments that I shared and include that in the mix of things that you're looking at as you're trying to come to a solution for this. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Noor.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I don't see any other members seeking recognition. And so Representative Noor, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Representative O'Driscoll. I'll be looking forward to bringing more tangible data. Unfortunately, we don't have the fire marshal on this hearing today. So I just wanted to ask for your support for this. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Noor. And I will renew my motion that House File 109 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy. And Mr. Brown will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cotizzo-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Daphne.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
No.
Representative Richardson. Representative Tice.
No.
There being 10 ayes and, well, I have six. Are you sure it wasn't seven, Simon? Seven. 10 ayes and seven nays. The motion prevails and the bill is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy. The next item on the agenda today is House File 448, and we recognize, we welcome Representative Akam to the Commerce Committee. I will move House File 448 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Policy, and Finance. And with that, Representative Akam, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 448 today. I am bringing this bill forward on behalf of a constituent, as well as many others in Minnesota who are also impacted by the current wording of the statute. My constituent, Ms. Weiner, I think has submitted some written testimony for the committee to consider. And this story really started 2 years ago when this committee heard and passed House File 2637, which was subsequently signed into law. The bill expanded the definition of what a prescription drug is as defined in this subdivision. And I'm with you today to clarify, to add clarity to the statute language to include those medications prescribed by a healthcare professional that are administered by injection or other parenteral methods, excuse me. Parenteral refers to medication that is administered in a manner other than digestive system. So the goal of this bill is that all prescription medications be treated the same regardless of method of delivery. And so that's in a nutshell. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Just for the committee's benefit, as a reminder, documents are in your calendar invitation if you're looking for any written testimony, not just on this bill, but bills generally. And for the public, it's on the committee webpage. There were no testifiers that asked to sign up for this bill, so we'll move directly to member discussion and questions. Any discussion to the bill? Seeing no discussion, Representative Akam, I don't know if you have any last words you'd like to give on this.
Not really, but thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Akam. And with no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 448 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance, and Mr. Brown will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cortez-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye. Separate.
Representative Haley.
Aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegarde.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Aye.
Representative Richardson. And Representative Tice.
Aye.
With 17 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 448 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance. Thank you, Representative Akam. Next bill on the agenda is House File 652 from Representative Cagle. Representative Cagle, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to move House File 652 to a motion.
I think the motion will be to the General Register, Representative Cagle.
Great. So I'd like to move that to the General Register, please.
Representative Cagle moves that House File 652 be recommended to be placed on the General Register, and I understand you have an author's amendment.
Yes. So thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 652 is one of the bills that was brought forward to us by the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, and during one of our first field hearings, I guess you'd call it, we traveled up to the White Earth Reservation, and we were made aware that some of the members there who had loved ones with opioid use disorders, they would get a prescription for a Narcan, and because of that, then their life insurance policy would be canceled. And so what I've done is I've worked with the life insurance industry to kind of tighten up some of the language and make sure that that life insurance policies are not able to be canceled or denied due to an opioid antagonist. And so what the DE-1 amendment does is just simply tightens up that language and makes it so that it is that it's solely based on the prescription for an opioid antagonist. So I'd like to move the DE-1 amendment.
Representative Cagle moves the DE-1 amendment, which is an author's amendment, getting the bill in the shape the author would like us to consider the bill. Any discussion to the DE-1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Cagle, I think you did a good job describing the bill. I don't know if you had any further comments on that. No. And we did have one testifier, Robin Rowan. Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. Life insurers are dedicated to promoting long and happy lives and healthy lives, and that's why we applaud and support the work that this legislature has done and the council has done in combating the opioid epidemic. Obviously, we need more people who are carrying opioid antagonists, and they shouldn't have to worry about life insurance eligibility because they want to protect the lives of others. At the same time, life insurers need to be able to accurately assess mortality risk. It's a duty that we owe to our policyholders. Representative Cagle's bill, as amended, accomplishes both those goals. So we are very pleased to be able to support it. It's similar to what 11 other states have done at this point, mostly East Coast states, so we're a pioneer in the Midwest. So lastly, I very much want to thank Representative Cagle for bringing the bill forward and for working with us, and I'm happy to answer anyone's burning questions about life insurance. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. And that is the only testimony we have signed up. So we'll now take member questions and discussion to the bill. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Cagle, any final words on the bill?
I just really want to thank everybody for working on this. And I think the, you know, we've been doing some really good work at the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, or as we call it, the OREC. And so I'm just really happy to be, you know, pushing the agenda of this council forward, and I'm glad we can get this done.
All right. And Representative Cagle, would you like to renew your motion?
I will renew my motion that House File 652 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Representative Cagle renews her motion that House File 652 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register, and Mr. Brown will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cortese Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Daphne.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
Aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Richardson. Representative Tice.
Aye.
There being 17 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 652, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. The last item on our agenda today is also a bill from Representative Cagle. It is House File 648. Much like our bill yesterday relating to catalytic converters, the intention today is to discuss the bill, amend the bill, and then lay the bill over. As I understand, there's continuing conversation between Representative Cagle and some of the stakeholders. So, Representative Cagle, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 648 be considered and then laid over.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. And then you have an author's amendment, I believe.
Yes. So House File 648 is another bill that came forward to us from the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. We've been hearing from some of the providers that are on that council and have been participating that there is a limit on the number of urine analysis screenings that they can do. And so if anybody's familiar with how treatment and recovery works, you know, you get screened for opioids or substance on a regular basis. I know that when my brother was going through treatment, he was tested at least weekly and at the very beginning, probably daily. And so what we're just asking is that folks that are in treatment and recovery, that they don't have a limit on the number of urine analysis screenings that they can do for opioids. I've been working with the health plans to kind of also tighten up that language and make sure that it only applies to people in treatment and recovery programs, and that, you know, the limits are for one a day. And so with that, I'd like to move the DE1 amendment.
Representative Cagle moves the DE1 amendment, which is an author's amendment, getting the bill in the shape that the author would like us to consider the bill. Is there any discussion to the DE1 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And Representative Cagle, I think, again, you have explained the bill, so we'll move on to testimony. We do have Dan Andreessen, who has asked to testify. Mr. Andreessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council Health Plans. So over the past week, as Representative Cagle mentioned, we've been discussing this bill, and we appreciate the changes in the DE regarding the number of tests and clarifying that this wouldn't include employers. However, we do have some concerns with the bill, and the concerns are not with the intent. We definitely support the need to help Minnesotans get treatment for opioid addiction, but we also want to make sure that there's protections in place to avoid fraud and abuse. And unfortunately, we see these situations of fraud in the healthcare system on the claim side, and this can mean patients end up receiving unexpected bills. And so as drafted in the DE, this bill would allow anyone to order a test for any reason and use a laboratory that may not be in a patient's network or certified to do these tests. So we'd like to make sure that these tests are being ordered by a medical professional in the expected course of treatment and being processed by a certified laboratory. So again, we thank Representative Cagle's leadership on the issue of opioid addiction and look forward to working with her on this bill together.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. That was the only testifier who signed up to speak to the bill. So we will now move to member discussion and questions. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for you on the Cagle bill and question for you on the Davis bill. So we're laying these over. Will we be bringing these back once we get things worked out to allow people to continue to testify and members to ask questions on the revised work that the two bill authors are looking at?
That's my intention at this time. I think it will largely depend on how the session progresses. You know, it's not an ironclad promise, but my intention is to bring both bills back.
That's all I need to hear. Thank you.
Further discussion to the bill? Hearing none, Representative Cagle, do you have any further comments you'd like to make on the bill?
Again, I'd just like to, thank the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council for all this hard work. And, I'd also like to really thank the stakeholders for engaging in all of these discussions. I think, we'll end up with a pretty strong package of bills from the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. And I'm really honored to be doing this work and hopefully helping some Minnesotans out there. So thank you, Mr. Fair.
Well, thank you, Representative Cagle, for your leadership on these bills. I think they're both excellent bills. From my own experience working as a prosecutor with treatment courts in Hennepin County, the availability of UA tests is a central aspect of the early parts of treatment. And so this is a really important bill, and I'm glad that we're going to be moving forward with it. And so with that, we will lay the bill over for further consideration. That concludes our agenda for today's hearing. So I will adjourn the meeting and we'll see you next week.